Hey, folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. Today, we are talking to Chris Whitaker. Chris is a former guest of the show. You might recognize his name from episode 618. We had him on to talk about the epic life of an adventure guide. Well, he has kind of gotten out of that world. Not really, though, because he's still doing awesome guided trips up Kilimanjaro through his company, Global Shenanigans. Which sounds really fun. All that's linked in the show notes. You can find them at global-shenanigans.com. But anyway, we talked last time. It was March 2020, like a week before the pandemic really kicked off. And we had talked because I record these a couple of months in advance, a few months before that. And it was, it wasn't really on our radar yet. But then all of a sudden, the pandemic hit. I know a ton changed in Chris's life from, that job was gone. You know, basically just no one was traveling. No one was doing anything. No one was definitely going on a guided adventure trip. So Chris put together a plan, and it took a while to achieve, but he and a friend decided that they wanted to do the Inside Passage, which is the 1,200-mile coast, basically, of British Columbia from Seattle, Washington to Skagway, Alaska. And it is stunning. It is mountains and glaciers and whales and orcas and, grizzly bears and forests and just beautiful islands. It's an unbelievable paddle. I've always wanted to do it. I hope I do one day. But he's going to tell us about the 72-day adventure that he and his friend went on to do this crazy achievement. So I was very excited to hear about this. He has some awesome stories. And I can't wait to jump in. So I tell you what, let's go ahead and do that. Here we go. Hey, folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. We have an alumni on the show who was on literally right as the pandemic was hitting the U.S. It had already been in some other places, but March of 2020. We talked to Chris Whitaker about basically the lifestyle of being a seasonal guide, jumping from season to season and hearing some of those stories and how he's done it and how he makes it work. And today we're going to talk to Chris, as you have heard in the intro, about kayaking the Inside Passage. Chris, welcome back to Adventure Sports Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on, Mason. Yeah, it was a lot of fun last time, and yeah, the adventures have continued since, and I think they've really just got bigger and better.
I actually don't know. You could be anywhere in the world right now, so where are you coming from, and where is home for you at this point?
Right now, I'm in Cornwall in the UK. I've continued working seasonally, continued moving around the place, but with COVID, it meant going back to the UK and finding guiding work down there. And Cornwall, for those that don't know, it's the very southwestern tip of the UK. It's a really popular place for summer holidays. People come down here. There's nice beaches, there's surf, and then obviously kayaking as well. So it's become a bit of a base during COVID years. This is where my parents are. So I was able to stay there and kind of reset as the pandemic washed over. But since last winter, I was back on the road. I got back to Canada for the winter season. I then did the Inside Passage trip over the summer, and I actually just got back from leading two trips in Tanzania last month. So I'm kind of between things right now, just come back to change over gear, and then I'll be back out again for the winter season in 2 weeks.
Isn't there like a perimeter southwest coast path or something around there? Maybe not. It's a really long hiking trail in the UK.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Southwest Trail, it goes, all through Cornwall into Devon, starts a bit further up as well. It's a long trail. A lot of people try and do it over either their whole lives or do it over a summer. And yeah, just walk the whole way.
The company I work for, Athletic Brewing, we've done some work there. Never had the chance to do it, but looks amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's funny that that's something you're aware of. Not many people would know about that unless they're actually from around here. But yeah, the whole coast around here is beautiful. Really nice coastal paths, nice sandy beaches. And yeah, it's just some lovely British countryside.
Tell us a little bit about the last 2 years? I know you said COVID was really probably threw a wrench in your plans, like it did most people in the sense of like adventure, but catch us up on what has been going on. I know we're going to talk about the Inside Passage trip, but what has developed in your life and what has either changed about it or what have you done? Because you said adventures of getting bigger and better.
I used the time to work on a project that I've had in the pipeline for quite a while. I'd always been hoping to one day launch my own guiding company and run my own expeditions in a few locations. And I actually went public with this idea in, I think, mid or early March about wanting to take groups to Kilimanjaro. And then the pandemic hit and it was very serious for a long time. So I kind of continued working on that, but was amazed by the uptake and the interest that came with it. I basically just put it on Facebook to my friends and wanted to take a small group of people that knew me, that would trust me, and kind of do like a bit of a demo run. And within 2 weeks, the first group of 10 was fully booked and I was on to making a second group. And unfortunately, because of COVID, we had to postpone twice. So the numbers changed a few times throughout that. But we actually were finally able to do that trip in September and October this year. So I just got back from doing that, taking some of the guys that have been booked with me for 2 years on an expedition up Mount Kilimanjaro and then on a safari afterwards. And which was incredible. Yeah. So it was something I've wanted to do for a while. We were meant to go last year as well. Couldn't do that. So instead I got a second location, which was a kayak trip to Sicily. So I managed to do my first group trips under my own name last year. And yeah, it's kind of just been an opportunity to work on that, try and build the audience, try and build the excitement and take people on these different adventures around the world.
Oh man, that's what it's about, getting people out there to do this stuff. So that's pretty cool. You shouted it out to your friends and you filled up one trip right away. Is that Global Shenanigans?
That's right, yeah. So that's Global Shenanigans is the name
of
the
adventure
tours. All right,
so I know we were talking about it, and I know you were doing this the last time. You at least had this handle in this website. Tell us the vibe. Like Global Shenanigans is just, it makes me think it's a pretty fun group of people. You know what I mean? Because
yeah,
a lot of guide trips can feel really, I don't know, prestigious and kind of uppity or really put together. I don't know. That gives me a vibe that it's a fun, goofy. You tell me.
No, that sounds about right. Yeah, it's just a group of people that want to have a good time, want to go on a big adventure. The people that come, they've maybe done a bit of traveling themselves, maybe not. It doesn't really matter. They just want to go have some crazy trip and don't really know where to start in terms of organizing it, or they may not have their own friend group that do these kind of things. So the first group I took was a lot of my good friends. Some of them actually went to primary school with. But then the second group was more of a kind of realistic group, people, some of them I do know, and others I do not, friends of friends and stuff. So a lot of kind of single travelers, solo travelers that wanted to come together and have a really fun, not so serious trip, do a big adventure, but yeah, in the most fun, laid back, kind of easygoing way. And I kind of organize the whole thing, arrange the logistics, do everything, just try and make it easy for people, just tell them what they need to bring, and I'll meet them at the airport, and then we're good to go.
And how did it go? How did they go, I guess?
It went great. Yeah, it couldn't have gone better if I planned it to go any smoother. Yeah, the weather was great. Everyone had an awesome time. Some of the people in the group had never been out of Western Europe before. So to take them to Africa and really experience a new culture, you know, new people, new language. Yeah, just really getting involved in something like that. And, you know, the reviews I've heard from them and the feedback back has been exceptional. So yeah, really excited to continue with that, head back again next year and add new locations year on year as we go.
Like most guides, they are, you know, balancing taking people on trips and also pursuing their own interests in adventure. And a lot of people use their interests to go do new trips, and then in the hopes or kind of with the in mind that it's going to eventually be an itinerary they can take people on. Is that what you're doing with things like the Inside Passage?
Yeah, it's an idea. The entire passage, I thought about this a lot during. I'm not sure it would be possible for the whole thing, but there's certainly sections that I would love to take people, particularly on the north end of Vancouver Island, where the killer whales come during the salmon runs in the peak summer season. I think taking a group there would be incredible, doing a multi-day inter-island kayaking trip there, trying to show people killer whales, humpback whales. So yeah, it definitely these itineraries are definitely inspired by the stuff I'm doing myself. Kilimanjaro came the same way. I'd actually been out to Tanzania on a expedition for another company before, and then it kind of led into the idea of coming back with my own group. So yeah, it's certainly a great way of doing it. And I really feel for my trips, I want to have been to all these places before I then bring groups, because I feel like for me to convince you to go, I have to know for sure it is what I'm saying it is.
Right. You gotta know. And it helps to know a few of the details of things to look out for, people to connect with. So that's awesome. Well, take us through kind of why the Inside Passage. What made you want to do this? Of all the things you could do, I'm always curious, how does an adventurer, especially with something so big, choose an adventure? What stuck out to you about this trip, and why did you end up doing it?
So the Inside Passage, for those that don't know, is it's a route in the Pacific. It technically starts in Seattle and goes all the way to Skagway in Alaska. I was working on Vancouver Island at the time, and that's part of where the route goes by. So it goes on the inside of all the islands, trying to find some shelter from the outside, from the bigger conditions. And I was working on Vancouver Island and met two girls at a pub who were doing the same trip. They were going north. This was in 2017. And that was the first time I'd come across anyone kayaking to Alaska. I'd only been in Canada for a few weeks at the time. And it just sounded crazy. It just seemed so big and so far. But throughout the season, it just kept playing on my mind. I kept thinking about it. And I was following their journey as well on Instagram. And the more time that went by, the more I started to think this is something I might actually be able to do. Like it might be within the realm of possibilities of a thing I could accomplish. And I think the thought just persisted over the summer, and I started to get quite serious about the idea, and it kind of grew from there. So it never really struck me about why. I think just as soon as I heard it, it just sounded like something that appealed to me. It just seemed like a crazy adventure. You know, you could go and explore, could kayak, kind of test my own skills, see wildlife, see new places. Like, it's all the things I'd like to do. So I never really considered the why until the trip began and people started asking me. It was more of the how kind of slowly developed. Like, how could I actually do this? And things got really serious when I spoke to my friend Nuka, who was a fellow guide at the time. He's done a pretty big trip before, so you know, I approached him about it. I figured, you know, if anyone was gonna, you know, join me on this journey, you know, I get on with him. We're good friends. We work well together, and I know he could do it, and he's quite likely to say yes. And yeah, fortunately, he agreed. And as soon as he was in, you know, we had our first trip meeting, and I knew, you know, this is seriously going to happen. You know, he brought organization to the crazy idea and helped it get some momentum.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. What were some of the early decisions, like time of year? How long is this going to take? Where are we going to camp? Getting a boat? Not sure if you had a vessel or not. What was some of that, those initial hurdles to get over? And maybe some of the things you were the most unsure about.
When to do it was a big one. It obviously changed as well, because originally we were going to go in May 2020. And with COVID, we had to postpone our trip twice. And in that time, my partner I went with, Nuka, his girlfriend became his fiance, and they had a child together. And there was now other commitments in our lives that, you know, it's not all about the kayak trip anymore. So in terms of how long it was going to take, it was, you know, I kind of put that on to Nuka and his partner Andrea to decide. You know, all I wanted was to do this trip, and the time frame was kind of more on their side, like how long can we go away for that would be okay. And we kind of settled on breaking it up into two halves, that around the middle of the trip, Nuka actually, funnily enough, he went and had to attend a wedding. in Ontario. So in the middle of the trip, I camped out with the boats, and he went to the wedding for a week. Got to see Andrea. Got to see his son.
What'd you do for a week?
Not much, man. Not much.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I read a lot of my book, some Netflix. Just waited. Just looked at the clock. No, it was all right. It was all right to have a good rest after, progressing so much. It was nice to have a long rest, but it was maybe a little too long. But it was part of the deal. I knew this was necessary in order to get Nuka on the trip. So yeah, the time frame, that was a big thing that affected how long we were going to be. And then another big challenge really was the cost of the whole thing and the equipment itself. So we in our early meeting, we were discussing, are we gonna try and make a film? Are we gonna make a video of this or that? And we realized that, especially now, like with Netflix, there's so many really, really well-made adventure movies and documentaries with a professional crew. They do everything, and there's no way we can compete to that kind of standard. But what we can do is make a really kind of raw, uncut, uncensored, kind of real version of what these trips are like. By filming it ourselves, be a bit amateurish, a bit less serious, and make a YouTube series and show people what it actually looks like the day in, the day out behind the scenes. So when we decided on that, we could then use that idea to approach some sponsors, and hopefully they could then provide some gear to us, and that would bring our costs massively down. So we were really lucky for the people that did jump on board, really helped us out a lot. It meant the only thing that we actually had to really buy ourselves was the food and then the boats.
Did you feel that you had to have a partner? Was it something you ever considered potentially doing by yourself?
I did consider it. The first summer when I got the idea was quite a few months of weighing that idea up, whether it's something I could do myself, whether I had the skills and ability to achieve that. And then really was, do I want to do it by myself? Because it really kind of it removes the fun out of it. So I was trying to focus on what the worst days would look like, which could be, 5, 6, 7 days of cold and rain and wet, and you're cooking dinner and you're also doing the washing up and you're also moving all the equipment by yourself. And I realized if you have someone with you, you can laugh about those situations. You can turn it into a joke. You can make it fun and you can keep going. But if you're by yourself, it's just kind of a bit sad and depressing to be in those conditions. It seemed like it was more of a chore. So that kind of whole mentality is why the name For Fun's Sake came up as well. It kind of brought the whole thing back that is the reason we're doing this trip. Like, it's meant to be fun. We're going to have a good time. We'll have some drinks as we go. We'll eat good food when we can. We're not going to just eat cans of beans every day. Like, we're going to enjoy it the best we can. So yeah, having someone come on board was a huge part of that, and yeah, wouldn't have ever found a better partner than going with Nuka.
For fun's sake, did that live up to its name, or was it mostly what did we get ourselves into?
No, it was really fun. Yeah, even the lowest days, I would still say were fun and enjoyable. When shit hit the fan, we were having a good time. We laughed things off pretty quickly. There was a moment where it had been about a week of cold, and we're in Alaska, so the wind is like biting. It's really cold coming off the glaciers, and it was just damp and wet. There was no way of warming up. It was actually the only time in the whole trip that I wore all of my clothes at once, just had everything on. And that morning, our cooker broke, and then we got our spare cooker, and that wasn't working either. And we were 2 days away from Juneau, and we have no way of warming up any water to make a coffee. We have no way of getting a hot meal. And for breakfast, we just had to eat our cereal bars. For lunch, we just had our tuna wraps. And then for dinner, we just had another tuna wrap. And we did that, luckily, only 2 days in a row because we're 2 days from Juneau. But that was, if I look back, that probably was the lowest moment. But still, as soon as the cooker broke, we were just laughing at it. We just shrugged it off. It is what it is. Luckily, we're both that. Those kind of people, we just have to deal with it and get on with it. And yeah, things were not going our way in that moment, but it is what it is. And yeah, we still found a way to have a good time throughout that.
So that route, the Inside Passage, it's very remote. There are, funny enough, cruise ships of people, seeing the icebergs, seeing the fjords and whatnot. How remote did it feel? Explain like the sense of wilderness in this area compared to maybe other parts of the world you've been to.
We certainly felt isolated. It's a very strange feeling because you are going multiple days without speaking to another person other than, you know, each other. But then you're there at night, and then a floating city that is a Disney cruise ship comes around the corner, and you can see them playing like a Disney movie on the big screen. And you feel, it almost makes you feel even more remote because you're just so far away from that experience. Like you are having a totally different, you're like in a different reality doing the same journey. It's really strange. Because it was basically only when we got into the towns that we would speak to people, because boats would go past, but they could be, you know, a kilometer or 2 kilometers away. Not that often was a boat close enough that they would actually say hi. You get a couple of people waving now and then. Every few days, a boat might wave because they can see you kayaking and they're considering how far away you are from anything. And they're kind of processing what these guys must be doing. So they're pretty keen to give you a wave and I guess make sure you don't need rescuing probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, you definitely feel isolated out there, which is the whole appeal. I think you do it because you want to get away and be immersed in nature and in the rhythms of the natural cycles, I guess, you know, following the tide, following the sun. That's just how you start to live and really get into that kind of routine.
Tell us about, yeah, just the scenery. It's just an amazing meeting of land and sea. Enormous snow-capped mountains, cliffs and rocks and gigantic trees and the ocean. Tell us about days that you spent maybe in awe of what you were seeing.
One of the standout moments for me, which was both in terms of the natural beauty of the landscape and a wildlife encounter we happened to have at this place, was at the north end of Princess Royal Island, which is in BC. And the top of this island, it's really, really steep cliffs with waterfalls coming off of them. So we're basically camping in a bay, a horseshoe kind of bay. There's a waterfall on the left side and on the right side. These jagged, steep cliffs, water running down. And then there's a very small plateau, just big enough to camp on. And then the beach goes out and then it drops down once again. So essentially where the beach touches the water, it's just another cliff straight down. And we're just nestled in there, really amazing campsite. And because of the waterfall, it creates a mist as well. So there's like a really eerie kind of fog right at the top of the mountain range. And the next morning, Nuka's making the coffee. I'm down the other end of the beach for some reason, and I'm walking back and I just hear a whoosh, which is the sound of a humpback whale. When they blow, it's like a shotgun blast going off. It's so loud, and particularly because of the shape of this bay, it just echoes off of the mountain behind me. And because the water's so deep, this whale's only about 10 or 15 meters away from me, right there. So I go back to the camp and I say to Nuka, like, you know, did you see that whale? That was amazing. He's like, no, what whale? And I start to explain what happened. Like, you know, it's just over there. How did you miss it? And as I'm talking to him, over his shoulder, I see 3 humpback whales all surface at the same time, vertical, with their mouths open, and they're coming right out of the water. And I just look at him in the eyes and like, turn around, turn around, turn around. And he spins around and he sees it as well. And they then drop back down. We both grab our cameras and rush over to the water. And what was happening, I only know because I've heard about this behavior before. I've never actually seen it with my own eyes. They were doing something called bubble net feeding. And when we got to the water's edge, we could actually see it happening. So essentially one whale, it dives down deep and it slowly releases air bubbles in a circle and it makes a net, like a lasso kind of shape. And as it does that, the fish or the krill or plant or whatever they're eating kind of gets balled together. And then one of the whales will give a call and all of them at the same time will then surface with their mouths open and they'll all try and grab that bait ball all in the center. So when we rush to the water's edge of our cameras, we're waiting there and about 10 meters away, again, so close, we can see this bubble net being formed. We can see this, like a bloop, 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 like on the surface. We see it happening and we point our cameras that way. And then, yeah, all at the same time, they just rush out of the water, and you know, we're both lost for words, like mouths open, completely awestruck at what's happening in such a incredible landscape all around us.
I can't imagine that moment of just saying everything up to this point has been totally worth it for that, for just that.
100%. Yeah, that's you know, I'd worked in Canada for two summer seasons as you know, people come on those trips to see whales and see killer whales, and I'd never seen bobblenet feeding before. Obviously, it does happen around there, and if you're lucky on a whale watching boat, you might get to see it. But to see it there is like as if they came to us. I know they didn't, but it kind of felt that way, that we were being, you know, rewarded or treated for our hard work and our effort of getting to that point. It's like, this is nature on your doorstep.
A BBC documentary level stuff going on right in front of you. Things that, that people wait years to see. That is awesome. That is really cool. Speaking of wildlife, I'd love to hear other potential wildlife encounters, because we have had someone on the show, a few people on the show before, talk about the Inside Passage. It's been a few years though, so there's been plenty of time to bring it up again and to hear a new perspective. And one of the things that has been mentioned a lot is one, surprising difficulty finding camping, at least for the people I've talked to, and two, the amount of grizzly bears. You know, it not just being like a made up part of a fear that you really shouldn't have, kind of like sharks in the ocean a lot of times or something. It's like, wow, there were actually quite a few. Tell us about that. How was the camping finding situation, getting camp every night? And two, did you have a lot of bear encounters, or were there other animals that were more of a nuisance or more abundant?
I have heard similar things on the campsite front, which is why we were sure that part of our day-to-day plan would to be around 3:30, 4 o'clock is when we start to look for a campsite. So we might have a rough stretch of a section that we think looks doable. We look at the charts and see that there might be water there, there's a beach there, or whatever it may be that suggests that there could be camping. And we are actually okay. Yeah, we didn't really have too much of an issue. Sometimes we'd get to a place that we thought we could camp on, we'd get out, have a look around, it's no good, we get back in the boats and we keep going. So I don't know if we just got lucky. Probably we just got lucky and found the right spots. Because in Alaska, we didn't have a guidebook. In BC, we did, so we were using that to find spots. So that might be one thing. Maybe a few years ago, there were maybe less resources in order to find camping. But now in BC, you have the BC Marine Trails Network, where they've actually made a lot of public resources available to show you different places you can camp. So that made the whole thing a lot easier in that section. And then in Alaska, it was just, it wasn't too much of an issue. We were just lucky to find places as we went. I was in a hammock and Nuka was in a tent. So we had different criteria. Often there was only one tent spot. So that didn't matter because I needed trees and there's trees everywhere. So that wasn't too much of an issue. And then in terms of grizzly bears, it was also quite a weird thing because, in a sense, it is the, in my opinion, the biggest danger out there, something you really don't want to run into, especially not at your campsite. But then it's also one of the main animals you really do want to see, because you've gone all the way there to see the, you know, the North American wildlife, and the grizzly is the biggest, meanest one of them all. So you're kind of in a strange place. But we actually only saw two grizzly bears, which I was quite surprised at. I was expecting to see a lot more than that. We were also a little bit earlier in the season than some people go, so the salmon runs weren't quite happening until towards the end of it, which might be a reason. But the two grizzlies we did see, it was under quite incredible circumstances, where we, through a new friend that we made during our trip, we were put in touch with the chief of the Kitasu Heihei Nation in Klemtu, which is in British Columbia. And we were given his mobile number and told to give him a ring when we get to their land. And we did. And he came down, introduced himself, you know, welcomed us, said, you know, feel free to camp down here, told us some places, and actually gave us a tour of the big house, which is the big ceremonial building for a lot of the traditional songs, dances, potlatch, that kind of stuff. Whilst he was giving us a tour, it starts hammering with rain outside. You can just hear it pounding on the building. And this is a big wooden structure with traditional art all along the outside. And then inside has a big sand pit with a fire pit in the middle, and then four totem poles on each corner. So an amazing building. And it's raining so much that he turns to us and asks if we have a campsite yet. And we say, no, not yet. I haven't set up camp. And he offers for us to stay in the big house, which was an amazingly generous offer. You know, at this point in the trip, just having a roof to stay under is incredible. But to actually stay in a building with such cultural significance, it was hugely appreciated to be able to do that. And we of course said yes, and Doug continued to give us some stories of the local history and the culture. And yeah, to be in that building and hear some of the stories from him was a real privilege for sure. But then it just so happened that he used to be a grizzly bear guide before he was the elected chief. And he offered, if we want, he would take us to find some grizzly bears the following day. He knew where the bear tours go, where they take tourists. And yeah, so I asked him, you know, what are our chances of seeing a grizzly bear? And he turned and said, 100%. So we're definitely going with you then. And yeah, he ended up taking us. We put our kayaks and a canoe for him and his friend Brady on the back of his boat. And he took us to an inlet nearby, anchored up, and we got in our boats. And yeah, sure enough, in this incredible meadow, there's a stream running down through the meadow with the mountains either side of it. And there's a couple grizzlies just in there. And yeah, he takes us right up to them, and we're asking him all these questions. And it actually put me at ease a lot more seeing a grizzly bear in that circumstance with someone who knows so much about them. He was able to tell me, you know, some of the things I kind of assumed but hadn't confirmed, you know, in terms of bear safety, what we should be doing at our campsite. And essentially said that as long as we don't give them a reason to come anywhere near us, that they won't come near us. You know, they're not looking for trouble, kind of thing. So as long as you don't come into one that has cubs, yeah, it shouldn't be an issue. So certainly put us at ease, but yeah, they're actually the only ones we saw during the trip.
Wow. What would you say, you mentioned a few there, but what would you say were some of the misconceptions about maybe the animals or what you thought was going to be an issue, but ended up not being an issue, or things that were the opposite you didn't think would be a problem, but were?
I was sure that there would be at least one night where a bear would come into our campsite. I thought it was almost unavoidable. Like we could do whatever we, as much as we tried to keep food out of the campsite or to not get food on our own gear and to keep the smells away from camp, you know, by having your kitchen further away from where you're camping and having all the food stashed away properly. I was sure that no matter what we tried, there would still be a bear coming into our camp at some point. Particularly being in a hammock, you just feel a bit more exposed that you're kind of just going to be swinging there. So I always had my bear spray within reach, but it just didn't happen. We were, again, maybe just lucky. I've heard some quite scary and yeah, unpredictable stories of when it does happen, because you know, what do you do if a bear is in the campsite? You know, do you try and scare it off? Do you play dead or just hope it leaves you alone, kind of thing? And particularly at nighttime, your options are quite limited. So that was a concern. It was something that was on my mind, but yeah, it just didn't happen. We didn't have any run-ins like that. But one thing that did become a bit of an issue, especially in Alaska, there were some crossings. It sounds like such a great problem to have, but there are some crossings where there were so many humpback whales, it was actually quite dangerous knowing that they are around and you really can't predict where they're going to surface. You know, there was one bit in a place called Frederick Sound where we had our biggest single day of humpback whale sightings, which I think was about 19 in one day. And that was like actually confirmed individuals. There was maybe more. But yeah, there was a moment where just watching so many, and some of them are making these incredible vocalizations, these strange kind of eerie, spacey kind of alien noises. There was some bubble net feeding and slapping their fins on the water, and there's some in the distance breaching, jumping out. and we're watching them for a while, and you know, it's just amazing. It's what we want to see. But then the time comes, like, okay, we now have a 7-kilometer crossing and we need to go that way. And there's so many humpbacks everywhere. It makes you quite nervous because, you know, they do surface closer than you want them to. And they are massive and they don't necessarily look before they come up.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
I was going to ask if they at all are aware, not that they need to be, but if there was just that natural awareness. If not, it's just kind of a gamble.
They are intelligent. They are smart, and they do have ways of, you know, sensing what's around them. Obviously, that's how they can find their food. But in my opinion, they've just evolved for such a long time, and the time that humans are on the water has just not been that long in comparison. So they've not necessarily evolved to have to look before they leap or to check before they surface. It's, you know, they've been the biggest thing in the ocean for so long. It's not a concern. And a sea kayak is such a puny thing that is just a non-issue to them. So
I'll ask, what about bigger boats? Do you know anything about that? Because I that's a great point. Same with a lot of animals that, you know, squirrels and deer, it's almost like their brain, you know, they have not evolved to deal with things coming at them 70 miles an hour, you know, so their decision-making doesn't reflect modern life, evolutionarily speaking. And I'm curious if you know anything about the whales too, with larger boats.
Yeah, humpback whales, well, all whales, I suppose, they do have collisions with boats fairly often. There's a lot of them have markings on their back where you can see a propeller has probably made it. Some of them do get killed by getting hit by the bigger boats like cruise ships and stuff. And the smaller boats often might hit the back of them as they surface for air because you just can't see them, especially in a slightly rough water. So with more people out on their fishing boats and the whale numbers, hopefully, well, they are increasing. Whale numbers are increasing in that area. It's just going to happen that there's more collisions. So there are a lot of campaigns actually trying to increase awareness of that, let people know this is a high density area for whales and you need to slow down, because it's like being in a car crash, you know. It will obviously hurt the whale a lot, but it will also hurt the humans behind the wheel driving, because your boat stops pretty rapidly. And yeah, some people have got in serious trouble from that happening. There's also the issue that humpback whale calls can travel for hundreds of miles, even into thousands of miles, their communication network. So with shipping lanes becoming more and more busy, the noise that the cruise ships and the tankers and other things let off, it actually disrupts the big network of whale calls and whale sounds. So I think it's a fairly recent issue we're kind of realizing and trying to see if there's a way to figure that out, is you know, and there isn't really a way to know for sure the effects it's having, but yeah, it's just another way that the whales are kind of affected by human shipping traffic.
I know you've mentioned a couple amazing camping spots. Tell me about one of the most memorable places you slept for the night. Was it that with that chief, or where those whales were bubble net feeding? Was it something else? Just was like, because for me, I don't know, something about finding that perfect spot. When you do, not every campsite's great, but when you do find it and you look around and you're like, I can't believe I'm here right now.
Yeah, both of those would certainly be up there in the top five. You know, the big house was such a special moment due to the significance of what was happening and the huge honor to be allowed to stay there. To see the humpbacks in the morning as well, just a totally wild encounter. But something that really stands out as well, we'd always be looking for, this is something that I really love about having a small little island to yourself. So when you can find one of those and there's just like a small beach, sandy beach, just enough for you to pull up on, you can walk around the whole island in like 2 minutes and just kind of knowing it's there and it's yours. There are certainly a few of them, you know, there's like one flat spot for a tent, two perfect trees for a hammock, like nothing else. There are a few of those, and that's what we'd kind of look for as number one. And it's kind of funny because it's actually, you're kind of hindering yourself because there's no water on there. There's no stream to fill up on. You're kind of creating yourself another thing to do the next day. But there's just something that appeals about having your own little private island. I can't think of the name of any in particular, but there was a few times where there was quite a few of them. And looking out for them was always nice. There's also something I hadn't thought of before we started. There's a small number of cabins out there as well. Some of them are actually made for public use, and some of them we stumbled upon. Others we met other boat users out there, some, you know, people, sailors, who would tell us, and would plug in on our chart where some cabins were that they knew about. So finding a cabin, particularly on a long, rainy, wet day, when you come across a cabin, especially when it's by surprise, is just incredible, because you've got a warm place to sleep. They often have a fireplace in there. People chop wood and leave it for the next person. And it just means it's a few less things for you to have to get out of your own boat and set up your own hammock and your own tarp. And a chance to dry out is just so incredible. So yeah, coming across some of the cabins was great.
Did you have to decide whether they were accessible or not? Or is it kind of the mindset out there that if it's there and you need it, you know, just leave it better than you make sure you clean up after yourself?
Yeah, that kind of thing. I think most of them are put there for that reason. There'd often be a sign inside and it will say, you know, this cabin was built by these people and blah, blah, blah. And there'd be like a guest book in there that you can sign and you can read back and read about all the other people's adventures. So it was often that. You do sometimes come across a cabin with a big private sign, and it might be like a private fishing lodge or something. So obviously you'd leave those and just camp outside of it or something.
Yeah.
But generally, yeah, they were there for people doing what we were doing, I think, or local people that knew about them and would go and spend a weekend there. I think as long as you, keep it tidy and keep it cleaner than you arrived, or leave it cleaner than you arrived, then it seemed like they were fair game.
What about, speaking of that, what about other people? You know, you mentioned seeing those cruise ships playing like Disney movies. I don't know about you, but sometimes I would be like cold and hungry or thirsty or something, just very uncomfortable after a long day. And I'd see vehicles drive by, maybe on a bike trip or something. And I'd see the people in there just like eating this giant burger or something. I'd be so jealous and like so envious, almost mad at them. I imagine you kind of had some of those same feelings. Maybe not with those big cruise ships. But did you run into any other kayakers, any other people doing what you were doing, any other people on big adventures, or people in small communities along this route?
There would often be sailboats anchored opposite some of our campsites. If we found some really sheltered ones, then the sailboats would go and anchor there. And we would kind of daydream about what they might have on there, like whether they, especially if we've ran out of wine, we'd kind of quite loudly talk about how much we wish we had some more wine. And it would sometimes end up in a shout. So we'd kind of daydream about what they might have and hope they might come and save us. And it would happen sometimes. We would, you know, if we got to a dock or a harbor, and there's one time in particular, we got to a place called Butedale, which has a dock just enough for, I think, four sailboats before they go to the Grenville Channel. And we pulled up there and we were completely soaking wet. It had been raining all day and had been for a few days prior. And someone came off the sailboat, gave us a shout, just said, when you guys are ready, if you want to dry out, just come on in. We got the fire on. We got some drinks in here. You know, feel free, come on in and like just come in your dry suits and dry out. So there were some incredible moments with people just wanting to hear our story and try and help us in any way they could. And then same when we came across the small communities, they were few and far between, but every week or so there'd be a small town, and we'd pull up and we'd, you know, wander around, and people were just always happy to help. People wanted to hear our story. I guess they were impressed by what we were doing and felt that we were a little crazy and that we needed as much help as we could get. And we had some meals given to us, some drinks bought for us, which is just really cool. Yeah, some really nice gestures of people. And I think that part of the world is just full of adventurous types, people that want to get out and love nature, and everyone's kind of on their own little adventure and are happy to help each other along on theirs.
Yeah, I imagine if you're out there, you're a little more rugged in the first place, and you're going to meet a lot more kindred spirits than if you were, compared to if you were doing this in some major metropolitan area or kayaking through there. So that's awesome. What would you say was maybe the most unexpected thing about the experience? Was either from like what you imagined it would look like, what you imagined you'd encounter, how it felt, how your body reacted, anything like that?
I think before going into it, because I've never done something like this before, I've done guided trips with groups up to 6 days, but never something more than that. So
like an actual trip, not bigger, not longer than that for you.
Yeah. So I'd only done 6 days before.
This is like 12 times longer than the longest thing you've ever done.
Yeah, this was 72 days total. So a big thing for me really is just not really knowing what to expect. Like there's only, you do as much preparation as you think you need to do. My style, I guess, is quite laid back, and I kind of rely on my own abilities to problem solve as I go quite often. And, you know, before going into it, I was wondering, like, have I really underestimated this? should I know more than I do?
So you were doubting yourself a little bit.
Yeah, there were moments like, you know, am I going to, especially with some of the navigation, there's some areas where you have to get to a certain place at a certain time due to the tides, because there's rapids and whirlpools and quite dangerous conditions if you go at the wrong time. So I was sure I could do this. It's stuff I've learned in training courses. It was what I'm qualified to do, but it had never really been tested in such a way. It had been tested under, you know, a controlled environment with other guides, some more qualified than me. So I'd never really put those skills to the test in the way that we were doing. So I guess that was a big thing for me, just, you know, can we actually do this? And, you know, fortunately, one of those tests is on the second day, a place called Surge Narrows. The islands are so close together that when the water goes through at the fastest flow, it creates standing waves, rapids and whirlpools. So that was an opportunity straight off the bat to know if we're doing this right. Do we know what we're doing? And yeah, fortunately we got there. It was completely flat. It was slack water. That was exactly when we wanted to arrive there. And yeah, it was very underwhelming, which is what you want. It's just completely flat and calm, and you just cruise straight through. And then I knew, yeah, this is going to be okay. We know how to do this.
Gosh, was there any other story you really wanted to share, some day that really stuck out to you, or just some reflection about the trip? Because I know it wasn't that long ago. You recently finished, so you're probably still processing it. You're going to process it for a while. It's a really long trip, 72 days. That's an adventure. That probably felt like a year. And so I'm sure it's taken a while to get through, like, what is different about me now on the other side of this?
Yeah, it's quite a funny thing. So I came straight off the back of that trip, and then I was immediately planning the Kilimanjaro expeditions that were happening just a month later. So the time to actually sit down and process it, like you say, hasn't really happened. I was kind of straight on to the next one. But now that that's done, I'm back into, for fun's sake, mode and editing photos and videos and speaking to people such as yourself. So I'm kind of reliving it again, which is awesome. I'd say one moment that really does stand out as one of my favorites of the entire trip, and definitely something that needs to be shared, was on our, I think it was into our second week. We were still on Vancouver Island. We had actually just left a place called Telegraph Cove, and we're leaving a bay. And so when we go across the bay, we just go from one point directly across the other side, save some time, no point going in it. And as we're aiming for this point, in the corner of my eye, I see some dorsal fins pop up. And after working on the island for a few years, I know straight away that they're killer whales. So I say to Nuka, there's some killer whales coming. They're quite far off and they kind of dove down. So we had some time to prepare. And it's a really, really calm day, completely flat, perfect conditions. So we get our cameras out, get ready. I'm there to take some photos. Nuka's on the video. And the killer whales are going towards the same point we are. So we know they're going to be coming closer to us. So we can just sit and wait. And sure enough, they surface again, and they're really quite active on the surface. There's at least seven or eight of them, and one calf as well, a really small one. And it's just an amazing encounter because we're quite early into the trip. We were unsure how long it would actually be until we saw any killer whales. And again, you know, we're just in awe of what's happening. They're so close, and it's such a calm day that we can just hear every breath that they take. Every time they come out of the water, it's just wild. But then something really wild that happens is in the corner of my eye, I see Nuka wobble. And this was strange because it was such a calm day. There's no waves. There's no wind. He shouldn't be wobbling. But then he says, there's one under my boat. There's an orca under my boat. And I turn to the side and see it surface about 2 meters in front of him, just comes right up and then rejoins the rest of the group. And what had happened, looking back in the video, this orca came all the way behind us and then it went onto its side. So its dorsal fin didn't come out of the water. So it's fully like stealth mode. It came behind us. And then as it went under Nuka's boat, it just gave him a little tap, just enough to kind of wobble him, but not enough to throw him in. Like if it wanted him in the water, it could have very easily done that. But it was just a little tap. We don't know why, you know, we can only guess. Maybe it was just letting us know it was there. Maybe because there was a calf, it was being defensive, or maybe it was just being playful or just finding out what we were. We have no idea. But in his video, you can see the white flash of the killer whale as it goes underneath his boat on its side. Then it rolls over to its right way up and then surfaces right in front. And, you know, our hearts are pounding at that point. We just can't believe what we've just seen.
And, you know, so early in the trip too, to be scared like that, you know, probably had some second thoughts right there. He's like, man, I got a family I got to get back to.
I don't know. Wild. It's funny. It wasn't really a feeling of being scared. We definitely, the power of the killer whales is intimidating in a way that, you know, they are so big and powerful and you are in their home, but there was never a sense of fear because I just know, I guess just from my own studies, that they don't, that's not a behavior they would do. They're not aggressive towards humans in the wild. So it felt almost like was honored that it came and gave us a little tap and then went on its way.
Like
it was
a fist bump.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. It was a strange thing, yeah, because it was a scary encounter, but it felt very intentional. And yeah, it was just, I don't know, saying hello, saying, announcing its presence. I'm not sure.
Wild, absolutely wild. Well, this is definitely kind of confirmed that this is something I want to do one day. I've always wanted to, but just hearing it again, hearing these stories, it's just unbelievable. The adventure and how pristine this wilderness is and how sheerly beautiful it is. How can folks, I know you said you tried to film it, tried to capture it, a lot of it. I know you probably haven't had time to process all that as well, but tell us about, you know, how can folks check this out or be able to watch something that you'll release at some point or just get more involved with what you're doing.
So we are creating a YouTube series of this adventure. The first episode is already on YouTube. It's the preparation episode. So it's basically everything up until the day before we begin. So I finished editing it like on that day, like whilst we're there, and uploaded it. And then we went. So it really is like right up until the moment we leave. So on YouTube, it's For Fun's Sake Expedition or at FFS Expedition. On YouTube, and then we're pretty active on Instagram and Facebook as well. But yeah, just searching For Fun's Sake Expedition or FFS Expedition, you'll be able to find everything we're doing. The rest of the series will be available during this winter. That's my next task, is to edit all of that. So I think into the new year, we'll hopefully start getting the episodes up, and there should be 8 of them coming.
Well, sweet. Well, let us know, and we'll be happy to plug them, happy to share them. And I will absolutely be watching them. Yeah, we have a newsletter that goes out. We'll plug it there. And yeah, would love to share. We realize that an audio format is great because there's people listening on an adventure right now. You know, I don't know if you listen to any podcasts while you're out there or anything, but we hear from so many folks. It's like, you know, this just gives me inspiration to get out there and do this. But there's also plenty of people who would love to, you know, have the ability to sit down and watch these experiences too, if those mediums exist. So whatever you got, we'd love to share.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks so much. And yeah, I'm happy to help people as well who are thinking of an adventure such as this. You know, I know it can be hard to find information. So yeah, for sure, if you're sitting there thinking you want to do something like this, you know, reach out. I'm happy to kind of share some resources and give some encouragement to those that want to get out and do it.
Until next time, which I'm sure we'll have you back on at some point. Every 2 years, just check in what you're doing. We'll tell the story. But yeah, thanks so much for joining us today on the Adventure Sports Podcast. And yeah, keep getting out there and doing this and taking people. That's what it's all about. We want to get more people to be introduced to adventures through someone experienced like you, and maybe they'll start to have the aspirations. Maybe it's never the Inside Passage. Maybe it's to do Kilimanjaro and then just to stay active and to stay outdoors and to stay involved in adventure somehow. Micro adventures all the way up to macro. So thanks for what you're doing.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks so much, Mason. It's been a pleasure reliving this adventure with you.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.